Hey everyone, thanks for checking out another podcast. I'm excited today to have my friend Ashley Jackson from Washington University in St. Louis with me. We're going to talk about her research. So she does work on how young Black children manage the fear associated with police violence in America today, and what are some of the implications of that fear and how that fear can be managed. We also talk about the history of race in America and how it relates to the development of U.S. policing over the course of the centuries. Talk about the talk. I'm sure everyone's familiar with it now. It's this idea that, especially for young Black boys, for kids, their parents or people that are raising them feel this obligation to have a special talk with them to prepare them for the realities of being Black in America and what type of implications that may have on a person. We talk about Ashley's focus on developing a community-centered approach to her research and not just having the community inform her research questions, but have them be active participants as the research moves forward and what value she finds in that. And we also talk about how religion and other factors can help insulate young Black people from the fear, these fears that we're talking about. Some of it's counterintuitive, some of it's kind of surprising, some of it not so surprising, but it's fascinating all the way around. I think it's really informative just with what's happening. I think this adds a little piece to the puzzle that everyone should hear. And as a special note, if you find this interesting and you're looking at hiring a new faculty member, please consider Ashley. She'll be on the market soon. She's finishing up her PhD. Brilliant person, would be a great addition to any faculty out there around the world. And if you want to help this podcast, if you find these podcasts useful, the one thing you can do to really help is like and subscribe, obviously, but also if you could write a review on whatever platform you're on, I'd really appreciate it. It really helps disseminate this podcast to more people. So thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. I hope you find this useful. Now sit back and enjoy. Thank you. Hey, thanks again for taking the time to join me. I gave everyone sort of like a brief introduction before we started the conversation, just sort of who you are and the type of work you do. But I think it's important for people to know a little bit about the lens that people see the world through. So just to get to know you like on a personal level a little bit, maybe, can you tell us where you grew up?
Yeah, sure. Thanks again for having me. I'm excited to chat. But so I grew up in Virginia, just outside of Richmond, in like a small suburb called Chesterfield. So yeah, typical like suburban life, not too exciting.
What did your parents, were you there your whole life? Did you grow up your whole life all the way to college? And
yeah, I grew up in Chesterfield, Virginia, and then ended up going to college in Northern Virginia in George Mason. So I basically stayed in Virginia until I graduated from college. But yeah, my parents are from the North, or from Jersey. They went to college in DC at Howard, and then they kind of made their way down to Richmond, Virginia. And my mom's a nurse, and my dad used to be a social worker, actually. He worked in like child protective services, but then he transitioned to computer science. So now he works in IT, and he's a computer programmer. So kind of like a weird turn and career, you know, trajectory for him.
Okay, cool. So, and how old are your parents, if you don't mind me asking? Like ballpark, I don't need to age out your parents' exact age, but
they're like 61. After 60, I lost count, to be honest. It's 61, 62, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. And they grew up where did they grow up? What part of the country?
Yeah, so my mom grew up in Newark, New Jersey.
Okay.
And my dad grew up in down by the Jersey Shore.
So. And what took them down to the D.C. area? Was it a job prospects, or was it a family, or do you know?
College. I mean, they both went to Howard University, and I think they wanted to be at a, you know, HBCU, and they actually met in college. They didn't know each other before then, and then they found out later, like, you're from Jersey, I'm from Jersey. Okay. And so, yeah, and I don't know why they didn't end up just going back to Jersey. But they didn't stay in D.C. because it's pretty expensive to, like, raise a kid in the district. So, you know, Richmond was sort of the next best bet. So that's why we ended up just outside of Richmond.
It's expensive to raise kids. It's expensive to get lunch in D.C. let alone raise kids. I can't imagine paying rent and trying to live there. So they met at college and then started a family and stayed there. And you... you were an academic early on, or it seems like you had a slightly different path into academia. What did you do before academia?
Yeah, no, I definitely did not think I wanted to be an academic. That was the furthest thing from my mind. I went to George Mason and studied it's the equivalent of criminal justice at Mason. It's called administration of justice.
Right.
But I wanted to be a lawyer actually. And so I was like, gonna, you know, studying for the LSAT, I was gonna sit for the test. And then that summer before sort of the application process got going, I interned at a probation agency in Chesterfield County. And it was a really awesome experience. I got to interact with a lot of probation officers and clinicians. And I learned that a lot of the POs had MSWs, master's degrees in social work, which I thought was pretty surprising because, you know, at Mason, most of the people in criminal justice programs want to be cops or POs or correctional officers. And so I didn't think that, oh, you could have a different sort of educational background and still go into, you know, community supervision. So I kind of like made a very last minute decision and applied for MSW programs all over the country. I knew I wanted to get out of Virginia, you know, eventually. And so that sort of is how I ended up going to school. And I should caveat, I graduated from college in 2009 during the height of the recession. So there like were really no jobs. And I figured like, I need to just like stall a little bit longer before the economy picks back up again. And so it was a good 2-year stall. I ended up out in Chicago. So I studied social work at the University of Chicago at the School of Social Service Administration. So I was there for 2 years. And really, I mean, that's kind of like how I ended up in the research space. You can kind of do two routes in social work. You can do the clinical route or the admin route. And social work's cool in that way because it's very broad. You can kind of fit the skill sets that you learn in a lot of different spaces. And so I ended up doing the research route and like the program development route.
When you started, you were thinking law school. And then
along
the way, did you think, oh, I'll do clinical work? Or did you right away go into the idea of doing research?
So that's a good question. I think I wanted to still do admin work, but more like advocacy, not necessarily research. So I mean, and I had gotten a little bit of introduction when I was interning at that probation agency in Chesterfield because they had me help with like an evaluation of their treatment program, which was basically like individuals who had mental health challenges, but also substance abuse challenges, but that were on probation. And so, you know, a lot of the clinicians and probation officers that were trained in social work were working with these clients to sort of get them to remain compliant with their probation sort of conditions, but also make sure that they stayed successful. And so, you know, I tracked things like program retention and, you know, at what point do people abscond or leave programming, like what sort of key factors. And that was kind of like a little bit of an introduction into this idea of like, oh, research is a lot of different things. It's evaluation. It can inform program development. And so I carried that with me, I think, to my master's degree program. And then I learned even more skills sort of in my MSW skill program around like advocacy. So learned a lot about reentry and a lot about sort of advocacy in terms of like how we can try to address the challenges a lot of people coming out of prison face in terms of like getting jobs, access to housing, things like that. I learned a lot about that in Chicago really for the first time. And so when I finished, I really was like, okay, I want to sort of fuse the two. Like, is there a way to be in a research space that can inform system change, right? Or some sort of like reform. So it's funny, I ended up not doing like peer advocacy work after I finished. It was more like research. And so that's where I started working at the Vera Institute of Justice in New York City. So I was there for a couple of years.
So you basically took this path from law school to thinking, well, I want to work in an advocacy space, and then realizing that utilizing research, learning how to conduct research, conducting research, that didn't preclude the advocacy work. It might actually enhance it or give you more tools in the toolbox. And then you end up working in New York and you're there for a couple of years. Can you tell me a little bit about the type of work you did there?
Yeah, sure. So at Vera, it's like a large nonprofit. They do work kind of all over the country, but primarily in New York State. They have an office in New Orleans where they do like pretrial work. But I was focused on juvenile justice issues. At the time, it was called the Center on Youth Justice. And so I was interviewing young people that were in limited to medium secure facilities in New York, learning about their experiences while they're incarcerated, what programming was working, what programming wasn't working, and why. And then I was talking to some kids that had reentered the community after being incarcerated. And again, just to hear about, you know, like what helped you, what really made you feel supported in that transition, and how can we sort of improve the situations for these kids that are incarcerated. But the project really that kind of brought me to this point, I would say, in my current research interest is this project we did where we interviewed young people and families who'd been impacted by the NYPD stop and frisk practice. So this is probably like 2011, 2012. The NYPD got sued by a number of different advocacy groups, Center for Constitutional Rights, New York Civil Liberties Union, and a bunch of other organizations, because they found that the stop and frisk policing practice was racially profiling communities of color. And I mean, the NYPD stopped, they made like over 600,000 stops in 1 year. A large majority of those stops were unfounded, so like no one was really engaged in criminal activity. So it was not only like a waste of resources from like an economic standpoint, but a lot of communities got harmed because of this too. Trust was essentially eroded over time, trust that was never really built to begin with, right? And so we really wanted to explore more in depth what this policing practice was doing to communities of color. And so yeah, we did surveys and we did interviews of young people and family members about what stop and frisk sort of looks like in their communities, what impact it has on sense of self, on their levels of cooperation with police, on things like that. And then we surveyed about 500 people too, to kind of get, so it was like a mixed method study essentially. And in that, you know, I heard a lot of really just awful and depressing and terrible things that the NYPD had done to a lot of young people. But I also learned about the fact that the relationship is complex, because, you know, a lot of the police are in communities that are impacted by higher levels of crime and violence. So there was this sense of like, we need some sort of public safety entity to keep us safe, but it's the manner in which we're being policed, the manner in which law enforcement is interacting with us, that's abusive and it's not okay. And so so that's sort of like the things that we learned from that study. And that, you know, ultimately I ended up changing jobs because it was like becoming a little heavy on me. I was learning so much about how law enforcement were doing the wrong thing and not enough about like, okay, where do we go from here? Okay, how can we actually start to, you know, restore some trust or just build trust right?
In the first place. Yeah, restoring trust, I think, is giving too much credence to the idea that the trust had been developed in the first place. But it certainly wasn't my experience in dealing with, on the other side of the badge, dealing with communities of color. I found that as soon as I stopped a car, if it was a black man or a black woman driving the car, then it wasn't just me and that person there. It was like 400 or 500 years of history that they were aware of, absolutely, and that I was aware of, that shaped us as individuals, that shaped the rules and institutions that we interacted through. And like this idea that race doesn't matter in policing, I just don't understand how people can not.
Yes, yeah, sort of, so obvious. Sort of, yeah, it's so very obvious.
You tell me about this. I'm sorry to talk, but what you just mentioned, like sort of this impact of being like stopped by the police. And it, when I was reading the paper, and for everyone, I'm going to put a link to the paper that we're going to talk about in a second below, but it really hit me. I had this experience where I left, so I was leaving policing to try to go back to school, but I knew I could make like $40 an hour working security as an officer while I was in school, if I stayed as like a reserve police officer, which meant that I needed to go in like once a month and work a shift kind of a thing for free. And it kept my certification and it helped them with manpower. And it gave me the ability to work these security jobs, which I needed to eat, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't have a pension or anything like that. So I was like, you know, I needed the money. And I had this, but I had this break of like 6 months where I was policing every day and then I wasn't doing any policing, and then it was my time to go in and do a shift so that I could keep this eligibility. And I got in the car with my partner, someone I'd worked with a ton of times, and we went out, and there were these like, it was like 4 or 5 young boys walking down the street, like in school age kids, and the Hispanic kids. We worked in like a migrant community in the Southwest, and mm-hmm. we like jumped out on these kids. You know, like they should have been in school. They're out roaming around. A lot of burglaries in the area, so we just, you know, did like stop and frisk, basically, where we stop them, mm-hmm. sit down on the curb, you know, mm-hmm. based on certain articulable facts, pat down a couple of kids, move their school bags off to the side. And it was something that I'd done 1,000 times, and it was something that was innocuous to me, and something that didn't have any kind of meaning to me after a while, because it was just, yeah. It was like if you work
just automatic.
It was part of my job, my daily routine. But having mm-hmm. that space of 6 months where I hadn't done it, and had been immersed in some literature about on the topic. And started.
I'm sure it was jarring for you. Like, wow, this is what I've been reading about.
Yeah, you know? I couldn't go back. So I had to stop. Yeah. I just couldn't do it anymore. I was like, I can't do that. I don't want to do that anymore. Because I knew it wasn't my partner and I being malicious. And it wasn't us. It was a structure that had put me in a mm-hmm. position where I was doing the reasonable thing. But when I objectively stepped back and said, well, how would I feel if I were walking through my neighborhood all the time and this is the shit I had to deal with, like getting thrown down on the curb, getting patted down, it's humiliating.
Yeah, and that quality of empathy is something a lot of people, not just law enforcement officers, but a lot of people in general just lack. The ability to put yourself in someone's shoes and think like, how would I feel if I were in this space and I was going through this? What would happen? You know, how would I feel? And then having that sort of influence your behavior is pretty powerful, I think. And I wish that there were more cops that sort of like have that aha moment of like, wait a minute, you know, this isn't okay, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot do, but I think it's hard to, like, you've got to do you're doing this job, and so there's this cognitive dissonance and this
totally,
pressure to like
totally.
To just say well to rely on culpability to say well. Don't be missing school. Don't be doing burglaries, you know, mm-hmm. when that's not the case. So I'm sorry to go. I went off on a tangent, but when.
It's an interesting story. That sort of moment of revelation that you had is. Yeah, it's interesting. Knowledge is power.
Yeah. And can make you very uncomfortable about who you are and what you're doing. So you did this research, and now you're working on your PhD, and you'd like to, I'm assuming, work at a university and conduct research and do your advocacy at an academic role. Is that sort of?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was sort of like was in a moment. I ended up quitting my job and I moved to Columbia. I was just like, I miss research, because the job I had after Vera was like a community development organization, and we were doing public safety work, like sort of working with research institutions and community-based groups to address public safety issues. And I really liked the model. It was sort of this research partnership. It was sometimes universities, sometimes research think tanks, but sort of working alongside researchers to kind of like explore and actually look to see what's actually driving safety issues in the community, as opposed to just saying, I know those kids in the corner are the ones that are causing the ruckus. Like, let's actually look at the data and see what it says. And instead of having punitive responses, like, let's create a community driven response. And so I really liked the role of the researchers, and I started to miss research a lot. I was doing almost all my work at Vera was research. And so when I had transition to LISC, which is the community development organization I just mentioned, it was more program development, technical assistance, and I really missed the research piece. So I wanted to make sure, like, if I go back to get for my PhD, is this something that I really want to do? And so I thought a great way to do that is to pitch a research project and see it to fruition and see if, like, you know, I can actually deliver, you know, and actually carry it out. And so that's ultimately what brought me to Columbia. I was there for about a year and a half. I applied for a Fulbright to do some research on just the role of local non-government organizations or like community-based groups and how they're supporting communities impacted by the armed conflict. And around that time, Columbia had just signed a peace treaty. So I was really interested to look at like, what does this look like there? But that interest in policing never went away. And so I did interviews with NGO leaders, and I wove in some questions about policing and found very similar stuff that we see here, which kind of just was like, okay, done. It's time for me to go back to school. Like, I want to get a PhD now.
So you did this really, comparative project in Colombia, and you left Vera and you were working for this, what organization sent you there?
No, so I was working at a community development organization called LISC.
And you got money? Did you get financing to go down there, like a grant? Or?
No, so I quit because I was like, I missed research. It was kind of like a job that I knew that there wasn't going to be an opportunity to be like a researcher, you know, in the sense that I'm thinking of, you know. Because it's an organization that provides primarily technical assistance to groups across the country in a variety of different things around like economic development. But my department was specifically public safety.
Okay.
And so I was just like, I need to make a move. I'm too young to be like already sick of work. I was like 28, 20. I don't know. I was too young to be thinking about, you know, that I'm tired of working. I was like, this is not healthy. So I quit. And that's when I applied for this Fulbright and you know, and got it, shockingly.
So the Fulbright was just for you to do as an individual. So you weren't affiliated with any institution. You just applied for Fulbright and got it on your own to go do independent research?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, University of Chicago were like my sort of overseer. So I was an alum of University of Chicago and they have like a Fulbright department. And they usually only give support to like current students, but I was like, can you help me out? Like, give me some insight into what this process looks like. And so they were helpful in terms of like how to frame my statement and, you know, how to really develop a strong proposal. But essentially I was sort of a lone independent researcher on the project. And luckily it got funded and it ended up being pretty fruitful. I ended up affiliating with a local university there called ISESI. It's a private university in the southern part of Cali, Colombia. And so they were really beneficial in connecting me with some of these local groups to talk to. So,
wow. I knew you had this experience, but I didn't know that you'd sort of done it. So like such in such an independent way. That's really impressive. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the paper that I read you,
sure.
but it sort of starts off just to lay the groundwork. It's sort of based on this that state sanctioned violence in the United States has been directed against Black people from the very earliest sort of stage. Can you talk about what role the police have played in that? I go back as far as you'd like, but just so like if someone's not really familiar with as policing as an institution was evolving in the United States. And I think everyone should at this point know that there's been state-sanctioned violence directed against mm-hmm. Black folks in this country, you know, since that's part of what made America America. Can you talk right. about what role the police and how that sort of played out a little bit?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not a historian, but I feel like, as you know, I feel like now in the year 2020, everybody kind of knows the history of policing now, or if they haven't, they should learn it quickly because it's sort of all over the news. You can't escape it. But really, I mean, the early roots of it were slave patrols. And I guess you could probably back it up even before then, when people were still enslaved, sort of this idea of, you know, arms of the state that, you know, legitimated violence to, you know, oppress Black people was sort of our early forms of that. And it sort of continued with slave patrols when slaves were freed, but not necessarily all over the country. People just sort of tasked with, you know, identifying individuals that were not free, that didn't have their quote unquote freedom papers and needed to be taken back to the plantation. So that was sort of like the earliest forms of that. But I'd even back it up and say it's like when the first ships left Africa. I think that's sort of when the violence was legitimated, essentially. And then, you know, it sort of weaves into Jim Crow laws, you know, creating a lot of barriers for Black people to advance, and creating these impossible and racist laws to prevent and prohibit Black people from sort of integrating spaces. And then that sort of weaves into the way that policing looks today. And a lot of people will say, well, you know, violence and crime is higher in communities of color and okay, but it, you know, it doesn't necessarily justify the fact that the treatment is very different A lot of that work, you know, people have done more research than I on the topic of like, you know, if you compare a white person to a person of color, how they move through the system looks very different in terms of prosecutorial decision making and outcomes, and who can afford bail and who can't, and who can get a job when they come out of prison and who can't. I mean, there's amazing research out there showing the disparities that when you literally compare the same sort of backgrounds of people, race is such a big factor in ultimately what comes out of someone's experience. So I think that it kind of, you know, state sanctioned violence, it's essentially evolved, I think. It's not as obvious anymore. Like slave patrols are like literally people running after you, you know, catching you and returning you to your master, or laws that were that now we believe are inherently racist. But now it's more insidious. And you know, and now it's in schools with school resource officers and kids of color being suspended, being expelled at much higher rates than their counterparts. So it kind of continues to persist, and all of it is justified by the state, which is probably why it's so dangerous and has persisted for so long. So.
Yeah, it's like if you like fascism in the 1930s is going to look totally different than it would today, because there's certain things that you can do and you can't do. Like you can't set up big gas chambers and like, well, not yet anyway, but like, it's not feasible. But that doesn't mean that we don't still have fascists who operate within the system in the way that they can and shape institutions in such a way to carry out the policies that they want to enact. But it's not going to look like it did. It's not going to be this, it's going to be the disproportionate number of pretextual stops in a particular state. And there will be sort of justifications for it because it's so institutionalized and it's so deeply embedded in our society that it's difficult to parse out. And even when you do parse it out, it's just so deeply this idea of culpability, and it's mind-boggling, and just a certain percentage of the population that I just think are incapable of seeing it, maybe. I don't know. I don't understand it. So you talk about, so we have this history. It's something that's sort of changed, it's and mutated into something new that's permeated, and not just policing, but you know, like housing, schools, like you say, it's everywhere. And then in the paper we're going to talk about like the actual like nuts and bolts of violence, though, which is the police, you know, the state's monopoly on violence is held by the police, and it's directed towards these young black men and boys specifically. So can you talk a little bit about, like, you say that, like, for black males, and I'm just going to quote you real quick. For black males, anticipating and preparing for involuntary police contact, unfortunately, is an inevitable part of life. Can you tell me, like, what does that look like for everyday life for young black men and boys who are dealing with this, based on your experience and your research?
So this is one of the reasons I was excited about writing this paper is, and I feel like you know this because you do so much research on policing, is a lot of the work on police violence or negative police contact uses adult samples. And I get it, it's easier to pass things through IRB when like you don't have to deal with like ESSEN and getting, you know, parental approval. But you know, we don't know as much about kids and how they're experiencing negative police encounters, specifically police abuse. And so, you know, some of the ways that people sort of prepare for this, or the reasons why people have to prepare for this involuntary contact, is just because of this history, right? We've seen the way black bodies are policed, and so this looks like the talk. So, and that's gendered too. So when I was growing up, my parents didn't sit me down and say, "When the police stops you, this is what you're supposed to do." They both had a general discomfort around law enforcement, for sure. I don't ever remember them viewing law enforcement in a positive light necessarily. But they always had to have a talk with my brother, and the talk changed over the years with him. I mean, the first time they had a talk with him, he's now 30, like 7, I think, 36, 37 or 38. They had the first talk with him when he was 6 years old. He got followed around in a record store. Don't know why a 6-year-old would be considered a threat, but at that
Six
point, he was a threat.
6 years old,
Yeah.
yeah.
And so my mom had to figure out a way to have this conversation with a 6-year-old in a way that he understood, you know? And it was hard and it was stressful. And so those conversations continued throughout. And then when he learned how to drive, it was like a whole thing. I'm like, oh God, now we have to talk to him about, when you go to the glove compartment, tell them that you're reaching for it, ask them for permission to open up your wallet. Like it was all of these things that he used to have to be told that he now just, it's automated. He knows what to do in the face of police contact. It shouldn't have to be that way, but it's for the protection of our community that Black people engage in that kind of conversation. And so, and also like the data shows this, right? Like cops stop and use force against people of color at much higher levels. I mentioned, formal processing through the criminal justice system creates a lot of disparities. So like, I think that this just programs us to feel as though we have to prepare. Psychology's done a lot of really interesting research around other forms of like preparation for violence. Not a ton on policing, so I'm hoping to contribute that, in my research career. But they've done a lot around different ways that Black people sort of prepare for bias, and racial socialization is a big part of that. And what that means is like sitting down and the familiar generational transmission of information about who you are as a Black person, what being Black means, how you can anticipate bias, the things that you should sort of prepare for moving through this world as a Black person. Those are sort of the things that go with racial socialization. And I didn't know there was a name for that. I just thought it's just like was my experience growing up Black, right? I didn't know that people had been doing research on this. So it's been cool for me to kind of unpack this more and learn more about bias and preparation for discrimination, and unfortunately the adverse effects that it has on mental health as well. But that's sort of like what anticipating and preparing for involuntary contact kind of looks like is the talk and the way you dress, the way you walk, personally, but also research that that I've done. The kids that we were talking to in New York, they'll say that they avoid certain corners, they'll take different routes. Avoid eye contact. And this obviously pushes up against respectability politics when you think about dressing and how you talk and changing that in order to appear more, quote unquote, acceptable in the eyes of the law. I don't necessarily love that. I think you should be able to dress however the heck you want to dress and talk however you want to talk and not get hassled, plain and simple. But these are some behaviors that I think a lot of kids of color and adults kind of activate for self-preservation purposes and self-protection purposes.
Yeah, I have a 15-year-old now, and he's not going to get a driver's license because it's too dangerous, and I'm not going to. It's not necessary for us. You know what I mean? Like we don't need to do it. And I don't feel comfortable with him at his age driving. But if he did get a driver's license, it wouldn't occur to me that I would. It wouldn't occur to me that he would be in some sort of extra risk that would require me to have some sort of special conversation. I would just think, oh, well, he's a reasonable kid. He's not doing anything. He's not bothering anyone. He'll be fine. And he has good common sense. I'm not worried about it. But if he were black, or if people viewed him as black, I would feel obligated just based on what I know about the world to have that conversation. I wouldn't know how to do it, but I understand that it is like that. That's something that people need to do. That what kind of a bur like if you have to do, because it's not just in policing, so it's everything that you have to do in life.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit maybe about like what does that do? Because that's an extra thing you have to think about, which is like so I'm older student, so I'm like in my 40s and I'm a PhD student, and I find that every once in a while, I mean it's not anywhere near comparison, like, but just so that I like to put get my head around it, I find myself a lot of the time thinking about that and thinking about the extra layer of dynamics between me and the professors and the students, and it's fine, and it gives me a lot of advantages in a lot of social situations. So it
Yeah,
kind of,
of course.
I think in the end, it probably helps me more than it hurts me. But it is an extra sort of cognitive load that I bear while I'm doing my going about my daily routine. And again, I feel silly using it as a comparison because it mostly benefits me. But can you talk about if you have to do something similar to that? but it's an insulating activity. So you're trying to defend yourself against like something that is very obviously a certain level of hostility towards your identity. What does that do to an individual having to bear that extra burden?
Yeah, I mean, psych research will say that like dealing with microaggressions, for example, you know, has a negative impact on mental health, particularly like depressive symptomatology, anxiety, and just overall psychological well-being. So just having to carry that. But there's also like just a natural, I don't want to say resilience because that it sounds sad, but like a requirement to just be resilient in the face of adversity because of, you know, just like historical discrimination. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's primarily what can end up happening is not only respectability politics and like sort of negotiating what kind of version of yourself you want to portray, but also over time it wears down on you in terms of like your psychological well-being. So
yeah, it's just across the board. It's going to have negative impacts, and this is something that we've shown in the literature, like
in public health too. Like racism is a, I mean, now people are, it's a sexy term to say racism is a public health issue, but there's a reason, you know, why, you know, rates of high blood pressure are seen among communities of color. In fact, there was this really cool study that came out a couple of weeks ago by Eliasa Sewell and colleagues. Elias is a sociologist out of Emory, and they found that, you know, living in a community, and I think that they did this research in New York, living in a community with high levels of aggressive policing was tied to really adverse health effects, so diabetes, things like that. So, I mean, you know, and obviously you can't make direct causal links, as they say in research, but I mean, that's a really interesting finding, and it really makes you think that, like, not only policing, but other forms of discrimination can probably manifest into really negative health outcomes, I think.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about, and I know I'm touching on a wide variety of things, it's just a lot of these you lay out in your lit review, you talk about these things, and I think they're so, just with what's happening in America today, because we have Ooh. Listeners from across the political spectrum here. We have some officers. We have people on the left end of the spectrum. So just, I think this is a really valuable opportunity to talk about some of these issues. Can you talk about the hoodie effect and stand mm-hmm. your ground laws? And do you see like a connection between like, because we see the George Zimmerman, you know, killing Trayvon Martin, being put in the same category in our culture as police killings of unarmed mm-hmm. black men. And I definitely see the connection. Can you talk a little bit about this vigilantism and police violence and if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. So, you know, I didn't realize this, but the judging, so some people viewing a specific group of people as a threat because of how they look, because of the garb that they wear, whether for religious purposes, for stylistic purposes, whatever. And so the hoodie effect is basically that. Seeing someone with a hoodie on and thinking, automatically having biases activated in your mind. And then I think it ties well with stand your ground laws because, you know, I mean, the sort of criminalization of the black body has a long history. I mean, I would even say maybe before, but definitely with like the Birth of a Nation, which was this like propaganda video that came out. I forget what year it was, but it was definitely at like the height of Jim Crow. but no, I think Birth of a Nation really was a really damaging thing for black people. It essentially made us look even more criminalized than people already thought we were, right? Like this idea of like black people are to be feared. And so I think you fast forward to Trayvon Martin and his, you know, wearing a hoodie, which a lot of black kids wear, a lot of people wear hoodies, period, right? But when you think about sort of how young black men are seen as predators before they can even talk sometimes, I mean, and just by wearing a hoodie, they're seen as a threat. And then stand your ground laws, which is basically like you can use a gun. You can use a gun for deadly force when there's reasonable suspicion to believe that, you know, that you need to defend yourself. Well, any reasonable suspicion can be activated by anyone if they feel as though they're, you know, being threatened. And so if you think that, black men are to be feared, and then you have a gun that kind of activates your, for whatever reason, need to defend yourself. For and I'm not saying this is logical. It's to me, it's irrational. I'm sure that you and I both agree on that. But I'm just thinking, I think that's why this gets connected to police violence, because they talk about implicit bias training and all of this stuff, and I have my own opinions about those sorts of trainings. But a lot of these things are not just police training, or not just Zimmerman just felt like shooting somebody. These are ingrained biases that we all quite frankly have. But I think that that's essentially probably what happened, unfortunately, with Trayvon, is this young kid, who to me would not be a threat, was seen as a threat in the eyes of Zimmerman, and then he decided to activate his, his stand your ground law in the state of Florida, where you can just, I guess, shoot anybody that you feel is threatening to you. What's threatening to him is not, would not be threatening to me, right? But I also think about this in the space of intimate partner violence. So as a woman, right? If I'm walking down a street, I don't care what race you are. If you're a man and it's 2 a.m. and I'm walking down the street, I'm gonna cross the street. Now, those are my biases kicking in, right? But at least those biases are sort of founded in historically, women have been
Absolutely right.
victimized sexually by men, But the same can't necessarily be true for all black people, That's why I think the bias just doesn't hold in that sense. There's no basis for the fear. It's programming, it's conditioning. It's people have been conditioned to fear the black body, and therefore it goes hand in hand with the need to activate use of force for self-defense purposes. It's actually not logical, but I think that sometimes things that you're conditioned around are not necessarily logical. And so there needs to be an unconditioning, and also just conflict resolution. We're so quick to call the cops when there's problems, activate some sort of violent response, instead of just talking to someone hey, where are you headed? I mean, quite frankly, I don't even think that Zimmerman would have been right to even ask Trayvon where
No,
he's
because
headed, because it's like, I don't know you. I can walk down the street and do whatever I want, but at least that would have been better than taking his life. So it's not a clear link, but it is, intellectually speaking, if you think about it, there are a lot of ways in which the hoodie effect sort of bleeds into stand your ground laws and creates a sort of vigilantism among civilians, I
And
think. So.
I think there's, like you said, it's there's no rationale. I think the rationale might be that when you kidnap people and you put them in chains and you bring them to another country and you force them to do labor and torture them and rape them and murder them, that you should be scared of a slave uprising. So like I think that early
True.
on,
Yeah.
that fear created an environment where the state rallied the population to all engage in a collective act to control the, black folks, native population, other racial identities that are, but especially the enslaved population. So when you build a culture in the South, especially, and in the North, I mean, it's not much better in the North, but when you build this culture that's designed to oppress and control a population, it makes sense to me that you would be scared because if you're willing to do that to them, then you would assume that they're going to do horrible things to you if they ever have power.
Yeah, that does make sense. And I mean, I'm not saying this in a threatening way, but I think that discomfort and that fear of retaliation, I think it's deserved,
Oh,
right? I
yeah, makes
mean,
total sense to me.
and also it's sort of what we as people of color feel every day, moving through a world that wasn't necessarily built for us to thrive. That discomfort that we carry with us to just keep pushing forward and keep achieving despite the fact that the cards have always been stacked against us. I think that the price that the United States has to pay, white people particularly, is the discomfort that, yeah, there might be a black uprising, and I can't say that it wouldn't be warranted. I think it's pretty impressive though that there hasn't been, I mean, there has obviously been, have been, powerful uprisings that have really done amazing things for the United States, but we have a long way to go as Black people, in terms of or not as Black people, but just as white people, and allowing us to be in spaces on an equal level playing field, and just to extend, the supports and the reparations that, quite frankly, white people were given.
Yeah, the
You know, it's been
benefits,
done before.
yeah,
Like,
absolutely,
help
yeah.
us catch up, and so I think that, it's the fear actually does make sense, but I don't even think that that's the I don't think that's an intellectual response. I don't think most people think Black people are going to come back for vengeance,
No,
like
it's become part of the culture because of that. So like it's become so deeply ingrained that now it's just part of our identity is to be scared of Black people, I think, in America. I don't know.
When really, though, it should be that we should be afraid of you all, because all over the globe, white men primarily have just used intense terrorism and violence. And so it's like it should be, we should sort of be clutching our purses, It shouldn't be the other way around, but that's another podcast,
Yeah, you're
I
preaching to the choir on that. In terms of like a justifiable fear, no one's scarier than white men. I mean, like
Right.
just think, I mean, like just in the last this century alone, just think about like Iraq. Like we went and killed, hundreds of thousands of civilians. It wasn't like, young Black men in Atlanta that did that. It was men, white men in suits in DC, New York that made those decisions. So, I mean, if you want to look at actual violence, yeah, it tells a very different story. But anyway, but yeah, that's a whole other podcast.
Oh,
Go ahead.
you could do a podcast on white collar crime, and that would just blow it out of the water. Because that's talk about some intense economic violence. Like, wow.
Absolutely. And I think another thing that is this, I think the that the another reason that the Zimmerman and the police get sort of clumped together, and for me, is that it's the nature of the violence. So it's like it's this prerogative, I think, power where there's no trial, there's no formal process. It's an individual making a subjective decision to use a level of force to take someone's life. So it's like kind of like George Zimmerman made decisions about Trayvon Martin's identity, and then he used violence against him that was supported by the state through the laws. And then you have a lynching where a group of white folks get together, they identify a Black body, they string the person up, and they are supported by the state. Even the sheriff might be in the crowd doing the hanging. There's postcard, you know.
Everybody is sort of in cahoots with ensuring white innocence, essentially, in both scenarios.
Right. So it's, I think that might be one of the things that sort of ties them together too, is just the nature of the killing as this prerogative sort of expression of power. Do you have, you talked a little bit about depression and related to rate, how one manages the cold hard reality of race in America. But unlike Joe Biden, who's just recently said that the Black community in America has no diversity or something along those lines, which is ridiculous. Can you talk a little bit about how, being Black means different things to different people, and how dealing with that, like on a mental health level, it can work different, it can play out differently for different folks depending on your background. Can you just touch on that for a moment?
So that's an area I'm excited to learn more about. I'm definitely not the expert on it, but so I guess I can only speak about it personally, and then I'll maybe mention some stuff that I've found in the literature so far. So psychology is in a lot around racial identity as being beneficial to addressing some mental health challenges. And so they talk about this in terms of racial centrality, so how central race is to you. And they also talk about it in this idea of private regard and public regard. So it's basically this idea that I assess myself based on what other people feel about me. Or that my like the extent to which one determines how a racial group views them. So it's like how I feel about my racial identity, but then how does society feel about me? And so there's some interventions out there that people have done. There's a recast intervention It's like racial socialization is like an effective way to buffer against the adverse effects of discrimination by like enhancing self-efficacy and confidence and like racial pride. Now obviously like the extreme is like white nationalism, so it's like not that kind of racial pride, but it's more like racial pride about being Black in the face of just historical discrimination and bias. And so I can't really speak to what the different mental health challenges across different economic groups within the Black community can look like. I can only say personally that I know that I feel like just within the last maybe 2 years, I would say, maybe 2 or 3 years, has mental health become a conversation that within the Black community is okay to talk about. I think mental health in general has a stigma around it for a lot of people, but I think, you know, religion is a big part of the Black community. It always sort of has been. And so I think, you know, there's a tendency to sort of like go to church and then, you know, deal with challenges there as opposed to going to formal therapeutic treatment, which can obviously be really beneficial. But again, it like depends on what the person's needs are and what they think that they need to sort of heal from different mental health challenges that they might face. But, you know, so I think stigma is like a big sort of challenge, I would say, in terms of like dealing with depression, anxiety, a lot of different mental health challenges within the Black community. And I think that where you're born and where you're from probably makes a big difference. So like if you're maybe first generation, maybe your idea of mental health is probably different depending on what that mental health infrastructure looked like in your home country. So I think it could look different, which is why, you know, Biden's initial comment was so stupid, because it's just like, we are not a monolithic group. We come from different backgrounds. Like, yes, our common identity is our skin color, and that we're all proud. Like, that's something we can all get behind. But you know, there are also challenges. There's colorism. There's you know, immigration status. There's age. There's generational differences, right? Like my parents' generational perspective on race and racism in this country looks very different than me and my brothers, right? And so, you know, and I think that bleeds over into like racial identity and sort of how that plays a part in your overall psychological well-being, how you process that. I could really talk about this for a long time. There's like hair, there's like, it's a lot. It's a lot to sort of unpack, I think, within the Black community. But we do not all experience the same things. You know, contrary to what Biden might have said, and what many people think, we're very different.
I think his age has a lot to do with him thinking the way he thinks about it. But even like, it's so ludicrous. Just, I mean, like he's comparing Black folks to Latino people, but there are Latino people who are identify as Latino and are from Latin American countries who are also Black. Like, there's like,
yeah, that are Afro Latino. Yeah, like, absolutely.
They would say, yeah, I'm Black and I'm like, there's no. It's just such a weird construct that we've created in this society, like race. Like,
well, I think that people feel comfortable categorizing, like it's too people, you know, I'm thinking like from a methodological standpoint, especially quant, people love to just like put people in boxes. And listen, like I sometimes struggle with how to make the best decision in terms of like data management about how to deal with different racial groups, but I think we as a society love to just box people in, you know, and to say like, oh, but Latino and Black, and you know, but no, Black from like, it's just like difficult for people to wrap their heads around the fact that like there are many different types of people in one racial group, you know, like that we are not all, we don't, and we move through the world differently. We don't have the same experiences. It's, but then we do. So, and if we, you know, sort of tout ourselves as being this melting pot country, then why do we love to still lump people in groups as opposed to like appreciating differences? It's just, yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, I guess it's a tool of empire. I mean, when you're mapping and growing and taking on and as an empire, I mean, that's what you do. Like, that's what the Romans did. That's what the British did. That's what we do. We categorize. Right. We break people down into groups. And if you're going to manage this big, huge society, this civilization, mm-hmm. and all this wealth and power, you know, you become obsessed with capturing capturing your population over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's really weird, but fascinating too, in a weird gross kind of way. You talk about, you mentioned a little bit about religion, and can you talk a little bit about how, because for me, like for a lot of people, like for me, I'm, you know, my generation and my cultural group sort of like drifted away from religion, and it's not a big part of my life. But for people who are constantly dealing with this extra cognitive load and these negative stereotypes and this constant sense that you're having to battle against things because of your identity, what role has religion played as sort of an insulator, as a technique for dealing with this stress?
Yeah. So I feel similarly. I'm pretty distant from like formal religious institutions. Like I believe in God, I believe in a higher power, those sorts of things, but I don't like go to church anymore. Which is pretty contrary to how I grew up. I was like in church every Sunday. I went to Sunday school, was in church choir. I was like a very involved sort of church kid, if you will. And so, you know, when we found in our paper that religious could serve as this buffering role, initially I kind of scratched my head. I was like, that's surprising. But then I thought about it. These are kids. So at that point in their life, they're probably very much still going to church, kind of like I was, right? And so religion obviously is playing this role for them that we don't necessarily know if it's attending religion, if it's number of times somebody prays. Like those need to be unpacked a little bit more. Our measure was just sort of religiosity, and it was on a scale of a lot of different questions that they could ask related to religion. But that's what we have to learn more about, of like, what is it about religion that's creating this sort of protective role essentially for Black boys in particular, that protects them against the adverse effects of being abused by the police. And other work has found this too. Black youth are some of the most religious youth in the country, which again, I was like, really? And then I'm like, of course, like just thinking about my own upbringing. Definitely a huge part of the lives of Black kids. And research actually finds links between religious activity and lower rates of depression among Black people. So, you know, there's like a wealth of research out there finding these links. And so I think that's a potential intervention point, but I don't think it can be the only one, especially because I think, so our sample was like in the 2000s, in the early aughts. And so I think that youth now are dealing with different challenges. I don't know if they have that same connection to religion that kids at that point had. And so I would want to see, like, if I could create like my ideal sort of intervention, how kids could sort of heal from negative police encounters. I think it would include some aspect of religion, but also around racial identity. So for the kids that just like don't want to go to church anymore, they're like over it. I think that like having some programming that would really bolster self-efficacy and confidence in their racial identity to combat that discrimination that they face, not only from police, but from school, from, you know, medical, wherever. I think that's really where there could be some huge gains. And you know, but I don't want to shut the door on religion, because I'm just making assumptions about what I think kids feel about religion now. It very much could be the case of Black youth still today feel a sense of connection to their church. I don't know. And that would be cool to explore more, like kids today. Right. What are their perspectives on it? And is it useful?
The paper is from the early aughts. Mm-hmm. So and again, I'll put a link to the paper so people can read it. Can you just maybe start out by telling us, so like we talked about we sort of set this all up, the experience of these young men and this contact with police, and talked about your research. Can you just maybe lay out like what was the central research question for the project that you had? What was the central research question?
Yeah, so I really was obsessed with the police abuse variable in the study. And because I just feel like in a lot of psychology research, like, you know, they talk about discrimination, they talk about mental health, and that's important. But I, you know, wanted to know in the context of police abuse, what that actually looks like. And so it was a little over 1,000 young people, boys. So we only focused on boys for this particular study. And again, a lot of that was informed by like the fact that males are the ones that typically have pretty bad encounters with law enforcement. And I think that more research now is coming out looking at sort of the impact on police encounters with females too, but this particular paper focused on young boys, age 13 to 17. And our central research question was to kind of test this, to explore, like, does reported police abuse impact mental health? So specifically, we looked at depressive symptomatology, perceived stress, and public regard. So when we're thinking about, like, psychological well-being, we didn't, the questions didn't necessarily ask, like, are you depressed? Like, there's all these proxy questions that get at symptoms that might be connected, that are synonymous with depression. And so this can be seen on the diagnostic, the DSM-5. It's like a scale that sort of tracks various different levels of mental health. So it's not just depression. It can be anxiety, things like that. And so that was one of our questions, or one of our variables we looked at. We looked at, you know, if police abuse impacts perceived stress as well, and then public regard beliefs. So those beliefs that I mentioned of how society views me. And then the second research question was, does endorsing, like, a higher subjective religiosity? So does sort of going to church, being, you know, involved in religious practices, predict depressive symptomatology or perceived stress? So, like, what role does that play in buffering against stress and public regard, or how society, or excuse me, perceived stress? And then the final question was, does religiosity actually buffer against the negative impacts against police abuse on mental health? Okay. I don't know if that was clear.
No, so you got, like, it's a nationally representative sort of sample that you're drawing
from? Yeah, about 1,100 kids, yeah.
And your question was, is, like, does exposure to police violence have a negative adverse effect on one's mental health? And then, if you're actively involved in religious activity, like going to church and involved with the church, does that, like, sort of protect you from those negative impacts? Is sort of the basic question?
Yeah. So if police abuse impacts depression and, like, sort of engagement in religion, like, what role does that play in terms of, like, buffering against the adverse effects of mental health? Yeah.
What were your central findings? What did the data tell you?
Yeah, so we definitely found, and again, this was surprising initially, but then when I thought more about it, it made sense. So religion played a really important role against protecting kids against the adverse. We say this in the discussion of, like, we need to learn more about what that looks like. Is it going to church? Is it, what specifically helped these young people produce more positive psychological well-being outcomes? But then also, you know, experiencing police abuse also sort of lower levels of public regard, which isn't great, right? When you think of, like, racial identity, this perception that society views me less favorably, we found that among these kids that were abused by the police.
So if you reported abuse by the police, then you thought the society doesn't view my, you thought that it was associated with feeling that society had lower value for your identity is basically,
yeah,
okay.
yeah, which, I mean, logically makes mm-hmm. sense, right? It's like society already views me as a Black person as, you know, to be feared, and then so you compound that on with experiencing police abuse. It actually made a lot of sense that we found that association. So
it would be neat. It would be worth doing, it seems, to, like, follow a group mm-hmm. over an extended period of time and see how it plays out over time. Are there any data? Is anybody collecting that sort of data, following a cohort that would lend itself to, like, a longitudinal sort of study or something like this? Or
I don't know. I mean, I know that this particular data set had an adult component to it, but I don't know if they ended up following them mm-hmm. after. I know the Fragile Family Study, I think, which is out of Maryland, but I could be wrong. I know they follow people over time, and they have questions about police contact and stress on moms, and they found some really depressing but interesting stuff around. So the long story short is, you know, there's work out there showing sort of, like, the adverse effects and, like, you know, of worrying about police contact, but police abuse and those effects over the life course, I haven't found any, and I'm hoping that will be my contribution. Is, like, we need to sort of see what this looks like in the long term, because we didn't find any impact on perceived stress, which is interesting, because you would think that if you've been abused by the police, like, you'd be pretty stressed out, right? And so there might be something salient about that age group that might be buffering them. We also found some like connections with like income. And so I think that there are a lot of factors that I think need to be followed through into adulthood if we were to do like a similar sort of data collection effort. And it would be interesting to see, because I think that at least in New York, most of the people that were stopped by the police were male, and there was sort of this like bell curve of like 16 to like 27 was just the hot spot group. They were just getting stopped left and right. And so I think that's a really interesting period of life to kind of hear from those people about, right? Of like, how did this perspective change from when you were young to now? And to actually follow those, not just like a new group of people in their 20s asking them, when you were a kid, what do you remember about the police? Because it's hard to sort of like recall versus if you survey them when they're a young person and then you follow them over a course of a couple of years and sort of learn about how their views shift for better or for worse. I think that could be a lot more powerful.
It sounds like there's like a rich research agenda that's available to you and lots of gaps. So if anyone who's listening to this or watching this works at a good university and is looking for an assistant professor in a couple of years, hit her up on Twitter and follow her. So when she hits the market, you can be the first to give her a job offer.
Oh, the pressure's on.
The pressure's on. So when you so now you've so you we there's a lot of things that need to be cleared up. There's a lot of unanswered questions, but we do have a picture emerging based on what you've seen so far in terms of the depressive effects of police encounters and police violence. What would you recommend in terms of policy? Is there anything we can recommend at this point? What would you do if I made you dictator perpetua of America for a year and you could institute change? What would you recommend?
I mean, I think like keep your ear on the ground and like a pulse on what specific topic you're setting. So in this case, policing, I feel like I try to always sort of keep in touch with someone that's like doing more work on the ground, whether it's a community-based organization or like listening into webinars where panelists that are actually from the community are speaking. Because like I think, I mean, this idea of like the ivory tower is pretty common within academia. Like we kind of get like wrapped up in our own research topics or, you know, studies that sometimes we forget that there's like other stuff going on, and like what this looks like on the ground is different, right? And it means and it has different implications. And so I think like to inform good policy change, like there has to be some connection to the community. And I mean, I want to be radical, and I don't think this is very radical when I say this, but I think having more research initiatives that are community driven is what I feel most comfortable doing, and I hope to do more of that. Because I think communities are experts in their own right. Yes, we as researchers have skills that we can bring into the fold, but I think communities also have like a wealth of information and things that we can learn from too. I also think that like social work is inherently built so we're always thinking about like interventions and like so what, you know, like some disciplines are like we study this topic and this is all the bad things we found, right? I think social work tries to, for better or for worse, take it to the next step and say, now how do we craft interventions and programs that actually support, for example, individuals that are victims of trauma. The Chicago Torture Justice Center is a really good example of that. They're on, I think, the south and west side of Chicago, and they've basically provided reparations, but also like community therapy, family systems therapy, individual therapy to individuals that were harmed by police violence under the Byrd sort of like Chicago PD, I don't even know, regime, I guess. And so I think, and then there's the RECAST program that I mentioned that does a lot around like racial identity and creating a more positive sense of self among Black kids, particularly kids that have been harmed by the police. So I think for me, a policy implication is like we know the problem. Like, do we need to really like release another study about like what police violence is doing to people? Like, we know it's not doing good things, you know, at some point. Those findings, I think, then have to inform an intervention strategy. My hope is that like you and I are going to be out of business one day, and that we won't have to continue studying policing because the issue will be resolved, right? And cops will stop harming people or feel that they don't have any other option but to harm,
Or we
right?
create a society where we don't need to police people. Like, I don't think whenever I think of my utopia, it doesn't include a man with a billy club telling people to move along, you know?
Well, right. And I think, social work right now is in this weird moment where there's a lot of just divisions within us that we don't know if we're supposed to align with criminal justice, if we're supposed to, just completely dive, if we're supposed to, we don't really know. There's not a united voice right now. And I mean, I've always worked in criminal justice spaces, so I'm just like, if not us, who? I think we always should be in these spaces working towards creating a more like just society with the end goal of abolition. Like, that is the end goal, but there are steps that have to be taken for us to get to that point. But I think that, like, you cannot lose if community and at least the people that you're studying are kind of like driving that ship, because who else is more of an expert than them? So.
So your answer to what do you do if you're dictator for a day is I don't exercise my dictatorial powers. I go to the communities that are most affected and most
Yeah.
familiar with the problem, and then offer my partnership and say, "Hey, I can provide you research. What questions do you have? We can help answer them. You can participate in the research, or lead the research. You know, be partners in the research, and then I'm here to help you make." You know, and make informed decisions, and then use my institutional power to magnify your voice in the halls of power. Is that sort of like your, that seems like your approach.
Yeah, 100%. Yep.
And I hate, I've had you here for longer than I told you. I originally told you an hour, a
Oh,
little
it's
over an
okay.
hour. So
No
I'm
worries.
gonna give you one more question, and I hate asking this question because the answer you just gave to was a perfect way to end the podcast, but just what you said about that sort of part, like the partnership, I think that's I love that approach. I think that's what's needed. But I want to give you one final, throw the mic over to you to close things out. Given what's happening in America today, the current crisis, the long history, what are your sort of final thoughts? Is there any sort of message you'd like to put out into the world?
Oh God, that's a big
I'm sorry.
question.
You can just say refer to my last answer, and I would take that as a fantastic answer.
I feel like my last answer is woven into what I would say. It's like, keep listening to the communities that are impacted. I mean, we know a lot, we're knowledgeable. And this is like kind of a geeky response, but I think it's important. And it's something that I've had an opportunity to do as a student at WashU is to not be afraid to engage in like cross-disciplinary, like, or trans, or like, what is it? Transdisciplinary work, whatever. Don't be afraid to sort of go to other disciplines and collaborate and learn. I obviously took a class at UMSL, in the crim department. I took a class in the psychology department at WashU, and the sociology department, and African American studies department, and have been able to sort of collaborate with a lot of faculty in those different spaces. And I feel like I've grown a lot. There's so many theoretical frameworks and just like framing of issues that I didn't think about, that we kind of you get wrapped up in your own discipline of like social work and there's a specific way, but there's not. I think in the social sciences we all kind of borrow from each other anyway, we just don't admit it. And so I think that more sort of transdisciplinary approaches I think are the best, but above all, let the community guide you and bring you to the promised land. I think that's the best option. It's hard and it's time consuming, but like, I don't know. It'll be done
So
right, I think. So,
a community-based transdisciplinary approach to solving social problems. I
yes.
like it. All
Yeah.
right. And with that we'll call it a day. And I just wanted to thank you so much. Follow on Twitter, and also put the link to your article in the description. And thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me today.